Thank you all very much for coming out this evening. As usual, I'm very, very happy to come to the Theosophical Society, whether it's to teach courses as I've done in the past or to just give a talk as I'm doing this evening. The environment is always so pleasing to me, a place that is dedicated to seeking, seeking for meaning, seeking for truth. A place which is conducive to harmony. People are usually very nice, very pleasant, providing facilities which are very conducive to the cultivation of inner harmony or peace. There is always a quiet spot where you can sit for a while, meditate. The grounds, as Ruthann was saying, beautiful grounds. I've been here during the day is the best time to enjoy them, to walk around. Extremely serene. And these sort of environments help us become aware of ourselves. And as soon as we do become aware of ourselves, maybe we become aware of how important it is for us to cultivate something of true value within ourselves. And true value means something that is a refuge for us. A place of peace, a place to rest within our own hearts, within our own minds. And this experience does require those few moments when we can stop running, because so much of our lives are composed of running, doing, achieving, meeting schedules, working towards something in the future that never seems to come. And not to say that what we pursue or what we do in life is trivial or bad. Most of us, I'm sure, do quite constructive, beneficial, good things. Earn a living, look after our families, look after our house, our garden. Maybe we do some community activities as well. I try to do all those things, but we're always very busy. And being in a state of busyness all the time, it's so easy to get lost. We get lost in this running, we get lost in the confusion, we get lost in the reactive mode of living. And we feel not only tired, stressed, but we also feel like we lose a sense of serenity. We lose that sense of inner stillness, inner peace. And not only do we lose it, we don't even know where to look for it anymore. So those moments that I was talking about, when you can come to a place such as this, you walk into a meditation hall as they have on the other floor, on the second floor, you go in, subdued lighting, silence. That is extremely powerful experience for us who live in the midst of noise. We go in there and we all of a sudden become aware of the noise within our own minds. We become aware of our inner turmoil, our inner confusion. And that reminds us, oh, I haven't got that refuge. I haven't got that place within me where I can rest. Because when I become aware of what's going on within me, it's just a jungle. And so, whether it's coming into a meditation hall, whether it's walking in the gardens outside, those opportunities when we become once again aware of our inner environment, the state of our own minds and how unpeaceful they are. Because that's a wake-up call. It reminds us there's something to be done. And I think that most of us are very fortunate because we have heard that wake-up call on numerous occasions, and that's why you would choose to come to a talk of this nature. Otherwise, you would probably be running somewhere else. So you've heard that wake-up call, and maybe you have even tried to find that inner refuge, create that inner space, create that inner state of serenity and peace. And maybe you have succeeded at times, and then you forget, and you get caught up in the running once again, and the mind becomes all stirred up and confused once again. And this is amongst the best of us. The majority of the people in the world, I would say, probably don't even appreciate the importance of cultivating an inner refuge, the importance of the mind, the importance of training the mind, the importance of exploring the mind, the importance of freeing the mind. It is only those people who appreciate the importance of these activities or these undertakings that are these people are concerned and interested in meditation. The Buddha said that there is nothing more precious. Nothing more precious. No one can be of greater benefit, greater help, greater service to us than the well-trained mind. And nothing can give us as much trouble, make as much misery for us than the untrained mind. And we're not talking about somebody else's mind. Our own mind. And he also said, this mind, something very, very beautiful, he said, this mind, in its natural state, in its true original state, is radiant. The mind, in its original state, in its more fundamental state, is radiant. But it is defiled, or it becomes tarnished. It becomes tarnished, that's a good word, by the defilements that visit or come through it. So this is something I'd like you to consider. Because he said, if you really understand what this means, you will be interested in mental cultivation. The mind, we all have a mind. You have a body, you have a mind. And if you don't quite know what the mind is, just be patient. You have a mind. The difference between you and a corpse is that which I call the mind. Everything about you other than your body is the mind. Everything about you, your emotions, your feelings, your thoughts, your aspirations, your fears, that is all mind. And it is the most important part of you. The body is important, of course. Healthy body is very good. But the mind is the dominant part of a human being. The mind determines really who we are, the quality of our being, the quality of our lives. The body is of secondary consideration. Not to dismiss it, but to put it in its right place. And so this mind, in its original state, in its fundamental nature, is radiant. Radiant means beautiful. It means bright. It means clear. It doesn't mean a jungle. But this mind becomes tarnished, clouded, or obscured. Its radiance becomes obscured. Or it becomes smeared over, confused, stirred up, if you wish, whatever. It loses that radiance. It loses that beautiful quality. It loses that peaceful quality by the, we could say, defilements that come into it. What are these defilements? What comes into your mind? Right now, if you were to stop thinking about the past, thinking about the future, thinking about work, thinking about home, thinking about the children, thinking about this and that, and all of these other things, if you were to just stop, and that moment when you do stop and you listen, you will hear silence in your mind. Unfortunately, in our Western culture, we have not really explored the silence of the mind. We have so overestimated the importance of the thinking mind. I think, therefore I am. If I stop thinking, do I disappear? So we never stop thinking. But here we want to explore that silence of mind. In that silence, you do not disappear. In that silence, there's a vibrant state of being. But I'm not being me, Caucasian man, middle-aged, ex-Buddhist monk, recycled Buddhist monk, part-time teacher, no hair. I'm not being all those things, because all those things are concepts, creations in the mind. I have to think about that. I am a Buddhist. I am a Christian. I believe in this. I believe in that. These are all creations of the mind. Before these creations, before these thoughts, these concepts, constructs arise in the mind, there is stillness, silence, brightness, peacefulness. If you wish, emptiness. Empty of what? Empty of creation. Empty of the multiplicity of thoughts, concepts. But there is still that knowing. There is still that bright, radiant state of mind. So the mind loses that peacefulness, loses that radiance, loses that state of clarity, and gets caught up in the jungle. And the jungle is our own creation. The jungle of thoughts, of plans, of memories, of fears, of hopes, expectations, all of that is our creation. And not only do we create it, we get lost in it. And we are burdened by it. And nature allows us to create anything. Nature does not really choose. Nature will allow us to create good and bad, beautiful and ugly. So some people then not only have a jungle of thoughts, they create a jungle of awful, negative, nasty, mean thoughts, full of anger, full of resentment, vindictive, hatred. Some people can create thoughts like that, do create thoughts like that. And not only do they create them, then they start actually acting on them. And that's where evil comes from. That's where evil action comes from. That's where all the cruelty, all the inhumane acts that have occurred throughout our history come from the mind. War starts in the minds of people. Cruelty comes from the cruel intentions that arise in the minds of human beings. Yes, that is true. But nature also allows us, if only we take the opportunity, if only we rise up to the occasion, to create that which is beautiful. To create loving thoughts, compassionate thoughts, kind thoughts, thoughts that respect life, respect the rights of others, selfless thoughts, thoughts that actually go against some of our more basic animal instincts, for self-gratification, because we respect the rights of the other. We respect the life of the other. And we know we can be gracious and we can be kind. And these thoughts then give rise to action. Kind acts, benevolent acts, acts of friendship, acts that are constructive to the well-being of many. And there have been many people who have taken that road. Nature allows that. And so we have in our world both saints and sinners, if you wish, saints and demons. We have in our world heaven and hell, hellish conditions created by people with hellish minds, heavenly conditions created by people with beautiful heavenly minds. And that is true of each of us. We can choose if we understand the mind and we understand that this mind in its original state is radiant. What determines the creation, whether it will be beautiful or ugly, is the way we think, the views that we hold to, the way we use our mental capacity to create. And so, for those who understand this, there will be mental cultivation. This is what the Buddha said. There will be mental cultivation. Because when we really understand this, that the mind, you know, it's the most important thing, and it will allow us to either go towards this jungle or towards this serene, peaceful state, the ugly or the beautiful. We will want to choose to go towards the beautiful. And that is what mental cultivation is, you see. Mental cultivation or meditation. That's how I define meditation, mental cultivation. And I like these two words, or at least the word cultivation, because it implies you are making an effort to bring into being something beautiful. You don't cultivate weeds. If you want to have a garden full of weeds, you don't have to do anything, just leave it alone. Weeds will grow. But if you want flowers or vegetables or some, you know, kind of beautiful garden according to things that are pleasing to you, then you have to make an effort to cultivate. Cultivating our minds. And this is meditation. Exploring, understanding how the mind works. What is this inner world that's so important to us, that determines the quality of life, that determines who we are, and yet it's so mysterious. What is it? And cultivating that which is beautiful in it. What is beautiful? We could list a whole number of things which are beautiful. And I've already talked about this by saying that we have this choice towards, you know, beautiful things or ugly things. Beautiful things, compassion, kindness, sensitivity, generosity, all these nice things. Patience, all nice things. But how can we create these things? You know, if you want to cultivate a garden full of roses and lilies and flowers, how do you do it? If you've never cultivated, you've never cultivated a garden, it's quite a difficult task. You just won't know what to do. So you want to get some information. How do I cultivate? What do I do? What do I put in the soil? How do I plant them? How do I care for them? How do I nurture them? Well, we want to cultivate these qualities, benevolent, kindness, patience, loving qualities, and how do we cultivate? You know, many of us would like to be very loving and kind and sensitive and patient and forgiving and wise and circumspect and devoted and on, and our list goes. But even when we want to, most of us don't know how, because we seem to just have, you know, we say the mind has a mind of its own. It's almost like we are just the victims, helpless victims of what? Where do these, you know, if you want to be kind, but you're selfish, where does selfishness come from? You want to be patient, but you tend to be very impatient. You want to be gentle, but you tend to become irritable and nasty. You want to be peaceful, but your mind tends to just fly all over the place. Where do these things come from, even if you don't want them? Why? Well, it's the result of conditioning. The result of just all the conditioning that's come from our, if you wish, genetic, hereditary environment. We are the result of our past. That's all there is to it. But we don't have to be this way. None of us are fixed. The mind can be cultivated. We can arouse just that little effort to choose our destiny. Meditation is the whole process of exploring the mind and empowering ourselves to choose this destiny. So in meditation, we are not really interested in, well, the way I explain meditation, I'm not really interested in a supernatural, miraculous, fantastic, extraordinary phenomenon out there. I'm interested in exploring and understanding the ordinary so that it becomes miraculous. It becomes something wonderful. In this book, The Meditative Path, I try to present in the most simple terms. Now, this training that we can undertake in order to explore the mind and really start listening, start observing. What does the mind do? What do you dwell on? What do you think? What do you do? How does the world around you affect you? How do you react to the world and situations around you? Why do you react the way you do? Beginning to notice that whole interaction. You as the center of your universe, the universe around you that you come into contact with, and how it affects you and how you react, why you react. If we can observe that, and if we can just try to remain very awake, very present, not get caught in this drifting, absent-minded existence. When we are in the absent-minded, half-hearted mode, then we are the victims of our habits and conditioning of the past. We just recycle the past. There cannot be the new. There cannot be the possibility for change, for growth, for choice. And so, one of the very fundamental requirements for mental cultivation, the fundamental requirements for that whole process of choosing, you know, what we want to create, one of the fundamental requirements is being awake. being fully conscious, being here now. Of course, we're conscious. We wake up in the morning and we're conscious. But consciousness has many grades. There's the dimly lit conscious, when you kind of, even best of us, you know, you just as soon as you wake up, you're kind of disoriented. Oh, yeah. You know, you're in a, we say in a daze, kind of a daze. At that moment, we're not really there. And we don't comprehend things very well. We kind of answer in a bit of a distracted manner. And we're just going through the motions of being conscious. So you could say that you're living in a very low level of wakefulness. And of course, we wake up a little more, especially after our cup of coffee or second cup of coffee. And I have somebody I work with, he needs about a gallon. After the first gallon of coffee, he starts functioning. I don't think I'm exaggerating, actually, because in America, everything comes king-sized, doesn't it? And you get these buckets of coffee, 24 ounces. That's a decent whack of coffee. And he's a very good man, but he's slow at getting going in the morning, so he just has to drink about three of these 24-ounce mugs of coffee. And then he starts functioning. Well, we all have our level of wakeful state and when it comes about. But even at our normal wakeful state, are we really awake? How awake are we in our normal conscious existence? Most of the time, we're not fully awake. We're still going through the motions. We're still kind of half-hearted. We're still absent-mindedly doing things. Because a lot of life is ordinary and familiar, and we can get by without paying too much attention. And so we do. But when we live like that, of course, that means no choice. No real choice to be sensitive. We cannot be really sensitive because we're not really there. We're kind of there. When we don't really have the choice to decide how to respond, what to create, because we are on almost automatic pilot. But we can turn this dimmer, if you wish. You know, like lights in this room have a dimmer switch. You turn the dimmer switch, the lights get brighter until you turn it fully on and it's fully light and you can see crystal clear. See, everything is clear, what's in front of you, rather than this dim lighting when you can't quite make out things. Well, this turning on of the light is bringing more awareness into the mind or making the mind more fully present. So the consciousness is imbued with this extra quality of fullness. We are here, we know we're here. There is this presence, we're fully here. Now there's different grades of this. You can see from the very weak, when it's consciousness with very weak awareness, very much going on automatic pilot. And then we gradually heighten the awareness till we can be really fully present. When we are fully present, what does that mean? It means we are sensitive. We know what's going on around us. We can be there when we feel what we feel as we come into contact with people, with situations. If we are slighted, we'll feel that. We'll know it. And because we know it, we can also understand it. Why? And we can also, if we stay awake, choose how to deal with that. So this wakefulness offers all these opportunities. And that is one of the most important qualities that is the foundation for any further understanding or growth. So we say, if there is mindfulness, there can be mental cultivation. If there is no mindfulness, there is no mental cultivation. There is no meditation or awareness. Mindfulness, awareness. I use them interchangeably. Now, having awareness is wonderful. And certainly in my training as a Buddhist monk, under my teacher for many, many years, if I can say, you know, quite often people will ask me, what did your teacher teach? And, you know, as if we always want to summarize these things in a nutshell. And I can actually summarize in a nutshell the emphasis of my teacher's teachings. Two main things. Just two. Because from these two, many other things are possible. For monks, he stressed monastic discipline. This does not apply here. The other thing he stressed for monks does apply for all of us who are interested in mental cultivation. Mindfulness. Mindfulness. The cultivation of mindfulness in every activity. So essential in the training that he provided for the monks there. And so essential, I think, for any aspiration towards mental cultivation. I cannot emphasize the importance of this quality enough. Unless you are awake, you cannot see. You cannot understand. There is no door through which to walk. Once there is my awareness, at least there's a door. You know there is possibility. And yet, mindfulness alone, awareness alone, is not sufficient. Because you know, but you cannot implement unless you have something else. Something which is the mental counterpart to physical strength. You've got to have some inner mastery over your own thoughts, over your own conscious creation. You've got to have some mastery. You cannot remain the victim. Most of the times we are the victim of our own thoughts because the thoughts, the result of the past conditioning is so strong that we just keep on recycling the same patterns. And even when we are aware, sufficiently aware, we know, I'm getting angry. But it's not I'm getting angry very long. I am angry. I'm completely angry. Because it takes over. Why? Why do these thoughts have so much power? Where does the power come from? Are you possessed? Where does the power come from? It comes from you. You create the thoughts. You give them the power. You feed them. You create the hell. No one can make you angry. I cannot make you angry. I can do many things to make you uncomfortable. But being angry is something you do, something I do. I create that. I create those thoughts. I feed those thoughts. I create that mental, emotional state. And why do I create it if I don't want to create it? Because I'm a victim of my own conditioning, my own habits. Even when I notice it, I can't stop. Why? Because I'm not the master of these thoughts. I am not the master of my mental activity. What enables me to be more of a master rather than just a victim? It is the power to direct your attention. The power to direct your attention also means the power to direct your thoughts, so that you can think what you want to think when you want to think it. You can direct your attention where you want to attend to. What is that power? Concentration. Concentration is just the ability for you to focus your mind and apply your mind where you want to, how you want to the task you want to. That's what gives us mastery, or that's what enables us to claim some degree of mastery, rather than just being the victim of our thoughts. So these two qualities, awareness and concentration. I often, whenever I teach about, talk about meditation, I talk about these two qualities. I've compared awareness to light, like that which makes clear, that which makes things crystal clear, what's going on. As it were, what is within you? What are you experiencing now? Where is your attention now? What are you thinking now? What are you feeling now? That quality of being fully here, knowing. Concentration is like a laser, when you can focus. Okay, I know what's going on, but I want to turn my attention here, and I want to dwell on this in this way. I want to think about this in this way. I want to consider this in this way. That gives me freedom. Freedom of choice. Because then I can choose to be sensitive. Being sensitive, I know what's going on. I can choose how to respond, how to approach life. And I can implement any wisdom, any understanding, any aspiration that I do have. And I also gather more wisdom and more aspiration, because as I choose to act and I act, I continue to observe and see the results. And that's where wisdom comes from. Wisdom comes from experience that is understood, not just experience. If we just experience, we just become experienced, not necessarily wise. But experience that is understood leads to wisdom. So this process of mental cultivation, exploring the mind, and then finding ways to develop these fundamental qualities that enable us to create what we want to create, which is peace and beauty, positive qualities. In this book, The Meditative Path, I try to present, you know, really simple techniques for achieving this, because this is all fine and good. Oh, I like all of this. This sounds good. Yes. But how do we do it? How do I become more awake? How do I stay awake? How do I learn to focus and direct attention? Well, we've got to train. And meditation techniques are simply systematic methods for training the mind. That's all. Like mental calisthenics. And I give a number of them in this book. Some of them are to do with formal meditation, like, you know, techniques that we sit down and we devote, you know, make special time to train the mind, to exercise the mind in being more aware and attentive, and in learning to focus by letting go of the restlessness and agitation, and stop being a monkey and start to center and focus and rest with the meditation object. The technique which I teach in greatest detail in my book here is mindfulness of breathing, where we use the natural flow of the breath as the object of attention, simply because it is a very good method and it's kind of universally applicable. In other words, anybody can do it. It's not faith-based. But it's also the technique that I practice the most and that I feel most comfortable with and that I find quite a beautiful experience. So I talk about that technique in quite some detail. And so about half of the book is actually devoted to this whole exploration of formal meditation technique, refining it. And it's not just telling you about it, you know, because understanding it is not difficult. Doing it is where the problem arises. Actually sitting down, doing it, and all of us know much more than we can actually do. And so I very much encourage putting it into practice, trying it. I really encourage the reader to sit down and try these mental exercises. Do it on a regular basis. See how it works. And then I also try to explore in this book the importance of seeing meditation as not just a meditation technique, but remember, meditation, mental cultivation, and in particular, cultivating awareness. Remember, wakefulness. This is possible and necessary, not only when we're sitting in doing a technique of meditation, but in every moment of life. It is possible and necessary, possible if we can arouse the energy from within ourselves to remain interested in the present. Necessary because without it, we slip into automatic, mechanical, habitual living. And so I encourage very much exploring how we can bring this quality of, if you wish, a meditative quality into ordinary life. When we're doing ordinary things like brushing our teeth, showering, watering the garden, housework, driving, talking, listening, reading, there is no obstacle to awareness. Activity is not an obstacle to awareness. Thinking is not an obstacle to awareness. You can think and be aware. The only obstacle is when we slip into mechanical, habitual living, forget the moment. And so learning to bring this quality of awareness more and more in our ordinary lives, turn the ordinary experience into a spiritual activity. And what I, the last part of the book is really then culminating in this thing of, okay, we've built up a foundation. We've got this foundation of awareness. We've got a foundation of concentration. These are the tools. Now let's use them to create the life we want to create, to shape our destiny. And that requires knowing where you want to go and what it is you want to create. And then implementing, working to create. And what I encourage to the creation of, inner peace, outer harmony. Living a life which brings you fulfillment. But the fulfillment will never come from acquiring things. Living a life that helps us create and make a contribution that we can be at peace with, feel good about. So these are the sort of things I present in this book, The Meditative Path. It was written over a very short period of time, about 4 months. That does not mean that it was written without sweat. I don't like writing in the slightest bit. I never write. I will do anything to avoid writing. I love to talk. Talk on the phone, no problem. Talk to people, I enjoy. But sitting down to write, just the pen and I are not good friends, let's put it that way. So writing this book was quite an act of discipline for me. It was possible mainly because the book was written in my head long ago. I've been writing it in my head, as it were, for many, many years, as I've been practicing, studying, and as I've internalized and integrated this process, and also shared this process. So it was there, and it was just a matter of getting that connection from the inside to through my hand to the paper, and it was a quite rewarding time for me. And I feel very, very grateful that Quest published this book, and certainly very grateful if you find it useful in any way in your quest for these things that we've been speaking about this evening. And let me just finish by saying that not only is the mind in its original state radiant, the mind in its original state is always available to us. It hasn't gone away. We've just covered it over. And we can uncover it. And we can all touch and experience this radiant mind.